Good afternoon and welcome to the LaRouche Show. It's Saturday, November 3rd, 2012, the Saturday before the U.S. presidential election. I'm Harley Schlanger. I will be your host today. With an eye on the election next Tuesday, Lyndon LaRouche presented his Friday Project webcast last night, in which he laid out the tasks before us on what we must do since neither candidate is qualified to serve as president. Earlier that same day, yesterday morning, in a press conference held in Washington, D.C. at the National Press Club, Mr. LaRouche spoke of his total dissatisfaction in the choices presented to the American people. And he said that above all else, Obama must go, as Mr. LaRouche knows that every day Obama remains in office, there's an increasing likelihood of the outbreak of World War III up to and including thermonuclear weapons pushed by Obama on behalf of the British Empire. As for Romney, Mr. LaRouche said that his failure to challenge Obama on the cover-up of what happened in Benghazi, Libya, on September 11, 2012, which led to the murder of U.S. Ambassador Stevens and three others, demonstrates that Romney is not committed to telling the truth to the American people, and that this disqualifies him from getting the support of Mr. LaRouche. Both the press conference and the webcast are available on LaRouchePAC.com website, and I would urge everyone not just to watch for yourself, but to get everyone you know to listen to it, study it, and think about it before Tuesday. At the press conference with Mr. LaRouche yesterday was Jeffrey Steinberg, who's going to be joining me today on the program. Jeff presented the case against Mr. Obama's foreign policy, which led to the murders in Benghazi, and his cover-up, which Romney has been either unable or unwilling to expose. As neither Mr. LaRouche nor Jeff suffer from the Romney problem, we can review today the case that Jeff presented at the press conference. We'll also look at the broader issues surrounding this election. That is, will the American people take the actions necessary to save our nation? So Jeff, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Harley. How are you doing?
Good. Let's begin with Benghazi. You presented a compelling picture of what happened using a series of emails, both before and after the Benghazi events. And this is a picture which I'm reasonably certain has not been presented in full yet to the American people before what you did yesterday. So I'd like to begin with you summarizing what you presented there at the National Press Club.
Sure. Well, look, the first thing was that we did not want to rely on any news sources, any rumors or speculation. In the last 2-3 weeks, the House Government Reform and Oversight Committee posted about 122 pages of mostly State Department documents that were submitted to the committee. All of the material that the committee made publicly available on their website was classified SBU. You'll see this capital SBU on virtually every paragraph of all of these documents. What that stands for is sensitive but unclassified. So in other words, the committee may have received, for all we know, hundreds of additional pages of classified material that they responsibly did not make public. But what those documents make clear is that in the period of at least 9 months leading up to the second 9/11 attack on the United States, which happened to occur in Benghazi, there were extensive warnings about the buildup of Al-Qaeda and related networks.
Now, Jeff, who is putting out these warnings?
These were all State Department documents. These were reports that were coming in from the U.S. Embassy in Tripoli, forward-based reports from teams on the ground in the Benghazi area. And so there was a steady stream of material For example, in December of 2011, there was a report posted on part of a longer document on the deteriorating security situation in Libya. This was 2 months after Gaddafi had been killed and the regime had been overthrown. And it basically said that they've got confirmed information that a number of Al-Qaeda operatives were deployed from Pakistan into eastern Libya, into the Benghazi area, and that one of these operatives alone had recruited over 100 people, some of whom later showed up in Iraq to fight against the government there, and obviously some of those same people have now crossed into Syria. So there were ample warnings that the situation on the ground in the Benghazi area was out of control. And in fact,
Jeff, some of these would have come then from Ambassador Stevens himself or directly under him.
Right. Well, beginning in June of this year, a whole series of documents, again, made available by the House committee, were documents that were prepared and were sent back to Washington under Ambassador Stevens' signature. There was a June 25th report about the deteriorating security circumstances in the Benghazi area. By this time, there had been an IED attack, an improvised explosives device attack on the U.S. consulate. There had been an RPG attack on the convoy carrying the British ambassador who was visiting Benghazi. There was a bombing assault against the International Committee of the Red Cross headquarters in Benghazi, and numerous attacks against local hospitals. And as the result of this, the British consulate was shut down in Benghazi. It's still waiting to be reopened. The Red Cross, which is famous for operating under the worst kinds of civil war and combat conditions, was forced to withdraw their entire mission from Benghazi because the security situation was so bad. And on August 8th of this year, slightly more than a month before he was killed in the attack on the Benghazi consulate, Ambassador Stevens sent a memo back to Washington that was headlined, "The Guns of August, the Deteriorating Security Situation in Eastern Libya." Going through this pattern of developments, there were many other documents that I did not present at the press conference, but which showed the State Department asking for increased security, asking for an extension of additional special security teams, including a team from the National Guard of Utah, which included a Special Forces Lieutenant Colonel named Andy Wood, who testified at congressional hearings about how upset he was when his team was pulled out of Benghazi in August, just weeks before the attack. So, in other words, the question that's begged by all of this is, why is it that there was not a deployment of Marine Guards to Benghazi, particularly in the run-up to September 11th? It was the 11th anniversary of the attacks that were launched against the United States. And
let me just interrupt you there, because I think it's important to get your assessment on a point which is obviously not speculative on your part, but based on your experience on these matters. With this flow of information coming in that you presented yesterday, that's available from that House committee, isn't it reasonable to assume that at some point the president would have been briefed on this, given that he put so much into the Libyan operation?
I think that that's an absolute reasonable assumption, and I think, you know, it's fair to also say that there's got to be some reason why the president has been absolutely dead silent on this. He's refused to say anything about what he knew, when he knew it. And so, yeah, that's absolutely, it's inconceivable to me in the run-up to 9/11 that the U.S. intelligence community would not have conveyed some sort of warning. When you have an attack on a British ambassador and the British pull out of Benghazi and the last Western flag flying in Benghazi is the U.S. flag, and you're coming up on September 11th anniversary, how could you not beef up security when you had this steady stream of messages coming into Washington from the embassy in Tripoli?
It also seems to me that one could say it's inconceivable that Mitt Romney, in the midst of a contested election in which the issue of the peace, war and peace in the Middle East is so important, that he would allow this to pass by. And I guess that's the key to what Mr. LaRouche said yesterday, that neither of these candidates are adequate for the job.
Right. Well, I think that, you know, we know a great deal about what happened inside the Romney campaign. There was a big fight over this issue, particularly after the second presidential debate, when Romney just saw how fragile Obama was when the issue came up. Remember in that second town hall debate that you had the Candy Crowley intervention, which proved to be absolutely false. You had Michelle Obama standing up and organizing an applause for Obama to basically prevent him from completely exploding. I thought at one point that his head might blow off. And inside the Romney camp, there was a big fight over this. Some people said, go in guns blazing on Benghazi. All you've got to do is ask one question to the president. Mr. President, you were commander in chief. Where were the Marines? Why is it that with all of the warnings, there were not added Marine security and other security forces available sent into Benghazi when the ambassador was saying the situation was out of control? That question alone, sticking to that alone, would have blown things up. But a number of campaign advisors argued that Romney was scoring so many political points on the economic failures of Obama that it was better to let surrogates handle the Benghazi issue. So you've had, in fact, quite a number of leading Republican senators who've taken the point in raising all of these questions, and you've had Fox TV in particular receiving pretty much of a nonstop stream of inside information from the Pentagon, especially on what was and was not done around that attack. So it was a tactical decision. It was a terrible decision because every senator in on the Republican side of the aisle could scream and yell and demand answers from Obama, and he can avoid him until after November 6th.
Right.
If Romney raised the question directly in those debates, the White House would have been scrambling the next morning to come up with a plausible explanation.
So the first point then that you made was that there had been plenty of advanced warning prior to the September 11th, that something could be expected, and that this was not followed up. It was not, no security, additional security was provided. Then the second point, I guess, is what happened during the time of the attack, and was there any consideration of sending in more forces as we had a small group pinned down by terrorists?
Well, I think that on that question, in the last 48 hours, on Thursday, the CIA gave a background briefing to a select group of journalists and laid out the timeline of what they did. And then the next day, the Pentagon pretty much did the same thing. And so what you had was a certain response on the part of the CIA team that was at an annex about a mile away from the consulate. And then you had other military forces moved into the vicinity. What's completely missing from the timeline of September 11th is any account whatsoever of what President Obama was doing. Now, we know a few things because the president's daily schedule is made public. He was at the White House on the 11th at 5 o'clock, which was 55 minutes after word got back to the White House Situation Room and many other government facilities around Washington that the attack was underway.
That's also confirmed by emails, right?
Yeah, exactly. There were three emails that were leaked to Reuters, were made public, and have not been disputed in terms of, you know, the fact that these were legitimate documents. One of them arrived at 4:05 p.m. Washington time, and it was basically about 15 minutes after the attack began, simply saying that there was an armed assault underway against the consulate in Benghazi by 20 armed men, bombs had gone off, and that the ambassador and three other officials from the embassy were in the compound and were in the safe room. At 4:55, a second cable came across saying that, at least for the time being, the attackers had withdrawn. And then at 6:05, a third message came across indicating that the group Ansar al-Sharia had taken responsibility for the attack. Now, I think the critical thing is actually that Obama has refused to say what he did. He definitely met at 5 o'clock with Defense Secretary Panetta and Vice President Biden. Later in the evening, he had a one-hour phone conversation with Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu. They were haggling back and forth over whether or not they would have a meeting. They were arguing about what a red line would be for a U.S. attack against Iran. So his mind was off the events in Benghazi. And undoubtedly, to have had a one-hour phone conversation, there was prep time, there were aides that were distracted away from it. So Obama was not on the job on this Benghazi situation to the extent that one would expect a commander-in-chief to be on top of things when you've got a diplomatic outpost under armed terrorist attack.
Well, especially when he presents himself as the commander-in-chief in leading the war on terror, which then brings us to the third point that you went through, which is the why is it that there has been a consistent pattern of cover-up, beginning with Jay Carney and UN Ambassador Susan Rice?
Yeah, well, look, on the day of the attack, the first email that came in, which was the on-the-ground report transmitted from Benghazi to the embassy in Tripoli, back to the White House Situation Room, the State Department, the CIA, the DNI, the FBI, right from that first moment, there was never a mention of a demonstration. What was reported was a heavily armed attack by approximately 20 people. And so there were supplemental reports that came in. It was not just simply that one email saying Ansar al-Sharia has claimed credit. There's a new report out as of yesterday that military intelligence, who undoubtedly also had personnel on the ground and had intelligence assets, basically reported at 7 p.m. Washington time that the attack was carried out by Ansar al-Sharia. Later in the evening, a CIA report, which was presented to the journalists who were at the agency on Thursday afternoon, said that the CIA team intended to go to the hospital where Ambassador Stevens had been taken and was already presumed to be dead. But they decided they couldn't go then because Ansar al-Sharia, the group that carried out the attack on the consulate, had the hospital surrounded. So when Jay Carney and then 5 days after the attack, Susan Rice, and then a week after the attack, President Obama, all were on national television, they told a conjured up false story claiming that it was a spontaneous demonstration. and not an al-Qaeda-linked attack, a premeditated attack on 9/11. Now, we know that anybody who wants to go to C-SPAN and check through the archives of probably dozens, if not hundreds, of Obama and Biden campaign appearances all over the country, you'll find that the overwhelming foreign policy story they like to tell is that Obama killed Osama bin Laden and that al-Qaeda has been destroyed. Now, the Benghazi incident made it clear that al-Qaeda is anything but destroyed. And the whole Obama campaign narrative was shattered by the events in Benghazi. And so what did they do? They made up a story. They told a fib, a big lie to the American people, in order to conceal the fact that their only big claim of foreign policy success has actually been proven to be an abject failure.
You're listening to Jeffrey Steinberg. This is the LaRouche Show, November 3rd, 2012, the Saturday before the election. And we've just gotten a précis, or an executive summary, you might say, of what Jeff presented yesterday at a joint press conference with Mr. Lyndon LaRouche at the National Press Club. And I'd encourage every one of our listeners to go to the website, LaRouchePack.com, and if you haven't seen it yet, watch the webcast, but also watch this press conference and see the documents that Jeffrey presented. Jeff, are we putting these documents up on the website, or is it just from available?
There's a PDF already of all of those documents, and you have both the video and, I believe, already the transcript press conference. But those 12 documents are up there on the site.
Let me just make this point, then, that what's clear is that there is, as you said, lies and a cover-up. Now, even some of the media, including Fox, have acknowledged there's a cover-up going on. But I think you may be the one person who's fully developed what's really being covered up, you and Lyndon LaRouche, that it's not just the events, the cover-up didn't just start on September 11th, 2012, but stretches back directly to the original September 11th. And that's what I'd like to get into next. If you had some other point you wanted to make still on 9/11 too, please make that. But I want you to go through this deeper level of the cover-up.
No, great minds think alike. That's exactly where I wanted to go with the deeper issue. Because, at the press conference yesterday and in a more sort of informal discussion with a group of colleagues today, Mr. LaRouche really went back to this issue. At the very beginning of January of 2001, I believe it was even before the actual inauguration of Bush and Cheney, Mr. LaRouche warned in an international webcast that this administration would be looking for a Reichstag fire type incident to justify going for dictatorship. Now, he didn't have some crystal ball or inside information about al-Qaeda's terrorist plans. In fact, the first of the terrorists to arrive in the United States had barely unpacked their bags when he said this. He was looking at the character of the team that had been put together under Bush and Cheney, and he said that they will go for dictatorship and they'll use a Reichstag fire pretext. As the summer of 2001 wore on, we were getting more and more indications of the likelihood of a terrorist attack inside the United States, and clearly U.S. intelligence agencies were picking up the same thing, and we know that there was at least one detailed warning to President Bush in the president's daily briefings that he was receiving a month before 9/11. So that attack occurred. We know what followed off of it. But the critical thing is that the investigations conducted by the Joint House-Senate Committee established without a doubt that the entire 9/11 attack back in 2001 was an Anglo-Saudi operation, and that the terrorist networks were protected, financed, and deployed by an Anglo-Saudi apparatus in which Prince Bandar bin Sultan, who already had been Saudi ambassador to the United States since 1983, and had actually come several years earlier as a military attaché, that Bandar was one of the several Saudi sources of funding for the operation. And in fact, the slush fund from which some of the money for the 9/11 hijackers was provided was part of the Al Yamama oil for weapons barter deal that Bandar brokered with Margaret Thatcher back in 1985, and it was reinforced and expanded under Tony Blair back in the late 1990s.
But Jeff, I don't want to go into great detail on the Bandar story because it's up on our website. You did an interview, a video story, what was it, a couple months ago on the real 9/11?
Exactly, yeah.
But I think and our listeners can go on the website and punch in on the search Steinberg, Prince Bandar, or Steinberg 9/11, and you'll get that. What I want to get at is what I think is the relevant point for what you presented yesterday, which is that there are people who are aware of this, including former U.S. Senator Bob Graham, who, as far as I know, for the last 4 or 5 years has been taking every opportunity he could get to insist that Obama declassify the 28 pages that have been suppressed of that 9/11 report, and warning that if it's not declassified, we could have another series of terrorist incidents.
Exactly. During the 2008 presidential campaign, Obama pledged that he would make sure that this 28-page chapter from the Joint House-Senate 9/11 investigation, which reviewed the issue of the financing of the 9/11 attack, would be declassified. In February of 2009, soon after his inauguration, Obama met with family members of the 9/11 victims in the White House, and basically, they urged him again to live up to his campaign promise. To this day, he has not declassified those documents. And furthermore, on the eve of his first visit to Saudi Arabia as president, Obama ordered the Solicitor General to go into court in a case before the Supreme Court and defend Saudi Arabia's right under sovereign immunity to avoid having to respond to any lawsuits, civil or criminal, relating to 9/11. In other words, he gave them a free ride. And that's been the case ever since. So Obama...
As Bush had, the same way Bush...
Of course, exactly. Bush classified the 28-page chapter and refused to allow its publication. And so we know some details, courtesy of Senator Graham and others, about what that chapter dealt with. And it dealt with Prince Bandar and several Saudi defense companies having been the sources of funding through Saudi intelligence of the 9/11 attacks. Now, I mean, this is enormously relevant now,
exactly,
because in July of this year, Prince Bandar was made the head of Saudi intelligence.
And I think the actual relevance goes far beyond Obama doing a cover-up to protect his election chances, but it actually gets at the heart of what Mr. LaRouche has been talking about, of the problem of empire, and in this case, the Anglo-Saudi Empire, which is behind much of these terrorist operations coming out of that region.
Exactly. Exactly.
And that's the same question now. What are we going to do in Syria? Mm-hmm. With the Saudi and Qatar arming rebels, many of whom are from the same Pakistani and Libyan forces that were fighting against us in Iraq and Afghanistan and are now in Syria.
You know, Mr. LaRouche made the point earlier today and briefly at the press conference yesterday that you've got to understand this oligarchical system. And in effect, you have a marriage of the British monarchy and the Saudi monarchy. The Al Yamama deal is sort of the contract that bound them together, but the same principle of oligarchical rule that is dominant in the Britain of the British monarchy and throughout much of the British Commonwealth, the British Empire as it currently is constituted, and the Saudi monarchy, they're involved in the same thing. The Saudis basically are financing internationally a spread of the Wahhabi form of Islamic fundamentalism. Over outside of Saudi Arabia, it's referred to as neo-Salafism. And what you've got are madrasas and much more direct, overt terrorist operations spreading all over Central Asia, Afghanistan, Pakistan, South Asia, into India, all over the African continent. We see it in places like Egypt and Lebanon, and you've got legions of these neo-Salafi jihadi fighters now swarming into Syria. All of this is being financed through Saudi Arabia. And as I say, the fact that Prince Bandar bin Sultan, the man who's got the blood of 9/11 directly on his hands, has been elevated in the Saudi hierarchy and is now the head of Saudi intelligence, tells you where this thing is going. And of course, from the British standpoint, it's an open secret that London is the biggest safe haven for these Islamic terrorist groups anywhere in the world. They have diplomatic and political asylum immunity. They're directly financed by the British government. We knew this prior to 9/11. Back in December of 2000, we submitted a memorandum to then Secretary of State Madeleine Albright suggesting that Britain should be put on the official State Department list of countries that support terrorism, because there were dozens of diplomatic complaints to the British Foreign Office that London was safe housing terrorists involved in attacks in Egypt, Nigeria, Israel, Jordan, Russia, you name it. Turkey was furious that the PKK, the Kurdish Workers' Party, had been given a satellite transmission capability to beam television into eastern Turkey, where instructions were given to PKK members to carry out terrorism against Turkey. So the Brits have played this imperial game for time immemorial, playing divide and conquer, playing ethnic separatism, religious differences, you name it. And the Saudis are critical allies of the British in pursuing this.
You know, Jeff, I think you just answered the question that Donald Trump keeps asking about Obama's origins when you mentioned this was an Anglo-Saudi marriage. Mm-hmm. I think maybe we ought to take a look at that, because that's certainly what Obama has been fulfilling.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, let me get into what Lynn said in the press conference and the webcast, where he said the real issue now is what happens after the election, that the election, it's going to come. We may not get an honest count. In fact, I'm pretty sure we won't get an honest count. We may not know in the next couple of days after the election who really won. In either case, it's not going to be someone who's fit to serve. But I would assume that whoever wins the election, the questions that you've posed on Benghazi will still be out there to be answered in much the same way that after Richard Nixon's landslide victory in November 1972, the Watergate issue and the cover-up continued until he was run out of office. Is that, would that be a fair assessment?
Well, Lynn said something today that I think goes even beyond that. He said, look, you know, the world has already changed, and as of the end of the voting on Tuesday, we're going to be in a completely different situation altogether, regardless of whether Obama wins or Romney wins. We're in a different situation, and he really honed in on what's going on in New Jersey and New York right now in the aftermath of Hurricane Sandy. The policies of Obama, the policies that he's pursued for the last 4 years, and the policies that Romney promises, his business-friendly solution to the American economic crisis, they're all completely bankrupt. And you've got a situation in lower Manhattan, in many parts of New Jersey and up into lower New England, where you have an absolute unmitigated disaster. We don't even know what the body count is yet. And I understand that power has been restored as of today in lower Manhattan below 39th Street. We don't know how many people died in high-rise public housing projects in that area because they had no power, they had no water, and how many elderly people in maybe the upper floors of these tenements simply died, and we don't even know it yet. Already, there are 109 people who died from the storm and 40 just in New York City. And the aftermath of this is going to require billions of dollars in reconstruction, and the money is not there unless we go with LaRouche's three-point program. Glass-Steagall, a credit system, and the launching of great infrastructure projects, one of which now, in addition to NWAPA, will have to be rebuilding New York City and New Jersey. These are, you know, massive, expensive projects because we've neglected basic infrastructure really since the time of the Kennedy assassination and going back even earlier.
You know, I think on this point, Lynn made some very interesting comments the other day. He's spoken so often recently, I don't remember exactly when he said this, but he said that you had two problems that come up from the budgetary side of this. One is that we don't have the in-depth redundancy in infrastructure so that power can be knocked out and there's not a capability to restore it quickly. We don't have the skilled personnel, we don't have the equipment, the material, the generators, and so on. And we're definitely seeing that now where, as of this morning, there were still over 3 million people who had not gotten power back. But then he said the second problem is what you just referenced, this failure to invest in infrastructure. I think it's very telling that what the Army Corps of Engineers did in New Orleans after Katrina saved New Orleans with the hurricane last year, I think it was Hurricane Isaac, and also Providence, Rhode Island, which had these storm surge barriers, was relatively undamaged. But in the lower Manhattan, Staten Island, there had not been the money allocated for the Corps of Engineers to develop these projects. And as a result, to save a few hundred million or a couple billion dollars, there's untold tens of billions of dollars of damage, as well as human suffering that was done because of this neglect.
Yeah, exactly. You've got this idiot mayor of New York City, Bloomberg, who up until yesterday was prepared to divert money and resources to run the New York Marathon when people were without food, without power, without water. And finally, after there was a massive outpouring of public rage, he had to back down. But he was asked about these Army Corps of Engineer projects. There are projects for water management in the five boroughs of New York City that have been on the books in some cases for 50 years. And Bloomberg callously said, no, we're not going to do that here in New York. So there's going to be a real day of reckoning. And that's what Mr. LaRouche is referring to, that the world is going to go through a dramatic change. The election itself has been, unfortunately, an extraordinary diversion because Obama should never have been allowed to be president. One way or the other, he must be removed from office. And Romney has put forward a series of alternative policies that are just simply a different pathway to hell. So the country is about to explode. We don't know what kind of reaction you're going to get coming out of the aftermath of Hurricane Sandy. But you could envision a social explosion. And what Mr. LaRouche said today is that we're in one of those moments where a trigger incident can set off a process that's revolutionary in nature. And what he's laid out in the Glass-Steagall credit system NWAPA proposal is the only thing that can work to basically restore this country to economic sanity and even accomplish the rebuilding of New York and New Jersey that's going to be urgently required. If you don't get some things moving in that direction, we are clearly headed for a social explosion, no matter who wins the election. And that's what he's referring to, that we've entered into a phase shift in the entire political landscape of the United States.
And I think a part of that phase shift is going to have to incorporate his discussion of breaking up the existing party system. If you think about it, and you know this very well from your work with the Congress, when there was ample evidence that the Bush and Cheney administration had lied to get us into the war in Iraq, and they continued to carry out illegal and unconstitutional measures, it was the Democrats, for partisan purposes, who took impeachment off the table. Nancy Pelosi, in fact, I think was the one who said impeachment is not on the table. And so here you had the Democrats in the 2006-2007 protecting Bush for partisan purposes, planning to win in 2008. Now we've seen the same thing, despite the many impeachable offenses of Obama in his 3.5 years in office. It's the Republicans, and Eric Cantor, I think, was the one who said there's no possibility for impeachment. It was the Republicans who protected a nominally Democratic president who was violating the Constitution. And I think this just underscores the absolute rottenness of the party system that, again, Mr. LaRouche has been tracing back into the 19th century and the British Empire's intervention into our republic.
If by some horrible turn of events, perhaps including massive vote fraud, if Obama wins the election next Tuesday, whenever we find out the results, and it could be days or weeks, if he is reelected, then the impeachment issue is immediately on the table. Day one of Congress being back in Washington. Congressman Dennis Kucinich, who I don't always agree with, said that the failure to impeach Bush allowed Obama to get away with what he's done. And you remember, Harley, back, I guess now, about a month and a half ago, I was a participant in a press conference with right. Congressman Walter Jones and with constitutional lawyer Bruce Fine and Colonel Larry Wilkerson. And both Fine and Wilkerson made the point that the founding fathers intended for impeachment to be a frequent recourse because they were concerned that even though they created a system of checks and balances, they were concerned that situations would arise, they thought perhaps even once every generation, where someone would get into the presidency who sought to impose a tyranny on the United States. And they did not want coups. They did not want assassinations. They created a constitutional and orderly process for removing a president from office if he committed high crimes or misdemeanors. So that mechanism has not been used properly in a very, very long time. There was legitimate reason for Nixon's impeachment and forcing his resignation, and there were even plans to invoke the 25th Amendment if they had to declare him mentally unfit to continue to serve. And of course, the Clinton impeachment was an abomination. It basically soured people on the issue of impeachment, unfortunately, because Bush and Cheney should have been impeached. Obama already should have been impeached. And had Congress acted properly, then we wouldn't be here in a situation 3 days before the elections, scratching our heads over the fact that we couldn't come up with a single candidate qualified to serve.
And not a single Democrat had the guts, despite so many of them who privately say they can't stand Obama, not a single one had the guts to take him on in New Hampshire in the early primaries.
Right.
And on the Republican side, we ended up with this disgusting clown show where Romney was the last man standing.
Yeah.
Now, I want to, in the last 14 or so minutes, come back to this question then of the solution, because this is what you and I were both recruited, not just to end the injustices, but actually create a system under which justice would prevail. And I'd like to talk a little bit about the region that seems to be so much a cauldron right now, the new Balkans, as Lynn called it not so long ago, the Middle East, that there's a potential there. If you broke the back of the British Empire and the imperial policy of the Anglo-Saudi grouping, that you could have with the U.S., China, and Russia a series of development projects that could transform that region. I know this is a significant part of what Mr. LaRouche has been discussing over the years with leaders in Russia, and I'd like your thoughts on that.
Well, it's definitely the case. You know, you've got, go back to, I think it was 2002, maybe a bit later, but at one point, Mr. LaRouche was invited with several other colleagues to participate in a seminar at the Zayed Center in the United Arab Emirates in Abu Dhabi. And presentation by Mr. LaRouche there emphasized that the Middle East Arabian Peninsula area is a crossroads of Eurasia Africa, and that with investment in nuclear power, which would provide adequate water through desalination, through building up of high-speed rail networks linking the Pacific Far East into Western Europe and down into Africa, this idea of a Eurasian African land bridge, this area could become a vital hub of world economic development. Now, you know, Lynn talks about the British Empire and the British monarchy and always distinguishes between that and the general population of the United Kingdom, most of whom are among the worst victims of the policy of oligarchism. And, you know, the Persian Gulf is a fascinating region in a similar sense. At the top of the various monarchies, you have really a classic oligarchical slave system. The vast majority of workers in all of the Persian Gulf countries are imported basically slave labor, to put a blunt label on it. They're brought in from Pakistan, from Thailand, from Africa, from various parts of the world, Southeast Asia, and they have no citizen rights. They live in squalid conditions. And so there are many things that are going on that are really horrible. At the same time, some of the money that's been generated by the massive amounts of petroleum and natural gas have gone to some pretty impressive projects. When Mr. LaRouche was in Abu Dhabi, he was invited with along with his wife and others to visit an experimental agricultural program on an island which was basically provided with adequate water through a desalination system, and they were growing every variety that you could imagine of fruits and vegetables and in that island area, they had actually modified the weather because they were getting more frequent rain because of so much vegetation. So you've got these little gems, these little pockets. The UAE has also contracted South Korea to begin building the first of what are supposed to be a whole series of nuclear power plants. So they're already thinking about a post-fossil fuel economy.
And Jeff, wasn't this actually the guts of the policy that Shimon Peres and Yitzhak Rabin intended to be included in the original Oslo Agreement?
Absolutely.
As the basis of a peace between the Israelis and the Palestinians.
Peres spoke eloquently, frequently, about the Oasis Plan for water development in the region to basically turn the area from desert into gardens. Now, I think the other critical aspect of this whole situation is, again, go back to the oligarchical alliance between the British and the Saudis. And in effect, you have an Anglo-Saudi structure. What's their policy? Their policy is to, at minimum, create a 100 years religious war. The conflict between the Sunni and the Shiites that we've seen in Iraq, that we see now in Syria, the overall framework of conflict between the Saudis and Iran, Arab, Persian, Sunni, Shiite. You've got a revival of the whole Kurdish separatist violence that's impacting in Turkey, in Iraq, in Iran, and Syria. All of these things are going on. This is a long-term British strategy of creating permanent war, and the worst kind of war, religious war. If you're not going to actually wind up going into a full-blown thermonuclear war of extinction, then the kind of war that the British and Saudis are promoting right now, with this religious conflict that's already becoming a dominant factor, it was the driving force behind the organizing of the second 9/11 attack, Obama's 9/11 attack in Benghazi. But it's spreading everywhere throughout the region. You look at recent statements and interviews by Dr. Bernard Lewis, one of the senior British intelligence orientalists who's been pushing this policy. He was the actual designer of the idea of clash of civilizations. Mm-hmm. Back in 1975, when he first came to the United States and became a mentor to Kissinger, Brzezinski, Cheney, and a whole generation of neoconservatives. What he's saying right now is that a new religious war, internal to Islam and between Islam and Christianity, is unavoidable, inevitable, and it's already begun. So they're talking about genocide on a massive scale in the form of this permanent, unending religious war, like what destroyed Europe between 1492 and 1648.
And Jeff, let me just get, because we're down to about 6 minutes, to the other side of this potential, which I think is something that many people are beginning to see, and they're having trouble dealing with it, but that is the relative rationality and sanity of the Russian policy, including, on the one hand, the Russians' very straightforward statement that they will defend their sovereignty, and if necessary, they're upgrading their nuclear forces to do that. But at the same time, you can begin to see that what the Russians are talking about is a pathway out of this crisis, out of this kind of warfare, because ultimately the target of this is Russia, including the areas such as South Ossetia, Dagestan, Chechnya, and other places where the Saudi-funded jihadists are operating, and also China with the Xinjiang province.
Well, yeah, I mean, Russia and China will defend the principle of sovereignty, particularly after Libya. They're also very sensitive, for good reason, about the fact that the United States is building a ballistic missile defense shield along the southern tier of Russia, nominally directed against Iran, but in fact directed against Russia, and that similar things are happening in the Asia-Pacific region vis-a-vis China and North Korea. The problem side of Russia right now, which Mr. LaRouche emphasized in discussions earlier today, is that you've still got these British agents running around inside the Russian government, the leading one being Dvorkovich, who has the economic and financial portfolio in the current cabinet. So you've got British creeps promoting the imperial system, the system of the IMF, the World Bank, speculative activity, bailing out the Western banks. This policy has a toehold inside the Russian cabinet even after Kudrin was fired last year. So there are undoubtedly tremendous war avoidance strengths that we see from Russia and China complementing the critical efforts by the U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff and institutional forces allied around them. But the Russians have to actually fully understand the requirements of sovereignty and get rid of some of these British monetarist creeps who still continue to crawl around the corners of the Kremlin. Otherwise, Russia is going to find itself in trouble. China is now feeling the effects of the disintegration and collapse into hyperinflation of Europe and by extension here in the United States. The markets in Europe and the U.S. for Chinese goods are beginning to dry up, and they need an alternative economic policy that breaks the chain of dependence on these areas of the world that are still under an imperial system. That's why ultimately the solution globally begins with LaRouche's three-point emergency measures to save the United States from economic disintegration. And that's the agenda that's on the table as of Tuesday night.
And these three measures require the removal of Barack Obama as the British operative on the scene in the United States.
And we also, you know, really need to go back to fundamental principles and go back to the idea that political parties were never part of the American system. George Washington warned about the dangers of factionalism and partisanship. And so what we need to start with is a presidency that draws upon the best, most qualified talent that the country has available and ignores party affiliation, in fact shuns it, because the business of the presidency right now, given especially the added picture of this crisis that we have through the aftermath of Hurricane Sandy.
So, Jeff, we've just about run out of time. I want to thank you for joining us today. And again, I want to encourage every single one of our listeners. I'm not going to tell you to go out and vote. I'm going to tell you, get your head on straight. Get into the real world. Take up the challenge from LaRouche that the American people have virtually given up our nation, but we can still bring it back. And the starting point for that would be to look at the webcast from last night, the Friday Project webcast of Lyndon LaRouche, and then the press conference from yesterday morning, or yesterday afternoon, from the National Press Club with Mr. LaRouche and Jeffrey Steinberg. And the issue before us is that, as Lynn said, the real fun begins after the election. We do have this opportunity. In a sense, natural law has turned against Obama, has turned against the British. We see the effects of that. We now have the opportunity to do something. But we have to do it. We can't just wait for it to fall into our laps, because it won't. So, Jeff, thanks very much for joining us today.
My pleasure, Harley. Talk to you soon.
And we'll be back next week with the LaRouche Show. It's every Saturday, 3 p.m. And again, by the way, next Friday night, Lyndon LaRouche we'll do a post-election Friday Project webcast that I would encourage everyone to join. So thank you very much, and we'll talk to you next week.